between the, well, we called it the third apostolic ministry, but Paul's travel to Jerusalem and his arrival took place in chapter 21, ended up with his arrest. And from chapter 22 all the way to chapter 28, it's really one section that's all about Paul in Roman custody. The first in chapters 22 and 23, he'll be in custody by Rome in the city of Jerusalem. In chapters 24, 25, 26, he'll be moved to Caesarea, and then he appeals to Caesar, so he'll be moved in chapter 27, and then finally arrive in chapter 28 in Rome, but all the time still in Roman custody, all the way through the rest of the book. So this last section, I just called it Paul in Roman custody from Jerusalem to Rome. And beginning in this chapter is his custody at Jerusalem. And if you recall, just at the end of chapter 21, when he was arrested and the mob was tearing at him and they have to lift him up and carry him above the people's heads and up to the stairs of the castle, that Paul then, talking Greek to the Roman captain, asked him for permission to speak to the people and got his attention by speaking Greek to him, Roman captain realizing he's not who he thought he was. And then when Paul turns around and addresses the people, he starts speaking Hebrew and therefore calms the people down, where all of a sudden they want to hear what this man has to say, since he's speaking in their Old Testament language. They probably speak more Aramaic, and that's, they say, how what the language was that was being taught in Jerusalem, as even when the Lord walked the earth. But the proper language of the Hebrew people is naturally Hebrew. And so Paul gets their attention. Now there's what do I got, four things I want you to remember as we go into chapter 22. One is something I told you is important, that I'm just going to keep saying it to you because it seems that other people just ignore it. I've never heard anyone bring it out, and yet I think it's an important part from here on out in the book of Acts. And that is that once Paul is brought into Roman custody, they're trying to figure out exactly what he is supposed to be charged with. Because, you know, there's a mob, they're going to kill Paul, and it's a riotous thing, and so the captain's going to have to give an account of the situation that's going on in Jerusalem. So he goes, rescues Paul out, but he just assumes he's a criminal, because why else would the Jews be so mad at him and yelling away with him? And so when he takes Paul, it said, look, just chapter 21, verse 33. It says, the chief captain came near and took him and commanded him to be bound with two chains and demanded who he was and what he had done. And some cried one thing and some another among the multitude. And when he could not know the certainty for the tumult, he commanded him to be carried into the castle. So he's under Roman custody. Eventually, they're going to have to charge him with something. And that's a theme that runs through here. Rome does not know what to charge Paul with. So I just remind you that, to keep that in mind, because it shows up in other verses, and if you don't know that's what they have in mind, you could misunderstand those other verses. Paul, as we said, is given a chance now to defend himself. That's what it's going to be called. And when he does, keep in mind that he's defending himself to an angry, confused, we just read the words there, that they're saying one thing, some are saying one thing, some another. They're angry, they're confused, they're unbelieving Jews. We said back in chapter 21 when he first arrived, he first presented himself to James, and then there's a believing remnant of Israel there that is questioning what Paul's ministry among the Gentiles is all about. But that's not who he's in the hands of. When the mob starts attacking him, those were Jews of Asia stirring up the unbelieving Jews at Jerusalem. And so this mob, he's now dealing with this unbelieving remnant in Israel, not remnant, unbelieving majority in Israel. So keep that in mind as we talk about that too. And then his association in ministry with and to and among the Gentiles, if anybody could actually articulate why they hate him, that's where the hostility is at. Now they haven't really communicated that, but we know it is, because even the believing Jews are confused about it. The unbelieving Jews accused him of bringing Trophimus or Tychicus. Who was that? Trophimus, I think. Yeah, verse 29. they accused him of taking Trophimus, an Ephesian, and actually a Gentile, and bringing him into the temple where Gentiles weren't allowed in. And Paul didn't do that, but it's that association of Paul with the Gentiles that really is the hostility behind all that. And then the fourth thing that I think you should keep in mind is that, and it's an interesting thing to think about, there is no hostility with James and the elders and the church at Jerusalem. That somewhere along the line, the unbelieving Jews at Jerusalem learned to get along, or at least not hate and fight and persecute, the believing Jews that are at Jerusalem. Remember back in chapter 21, James told Paul in verse 20, and when they heard it, they glorified the Lord and said unto him, Thou seest, brethren, how many thousands of Jews there are which believe, and they're all zealous of the law. So there's this lot of believing Jews there. The unbelieving Jews, they're mad at Paul, but they don't have the same hostility toward James or the elders. And if the apostles were around, I would think toward Peter and John as well, and the rest of the apostles. Which is interesting, because it just makes everything stand out, the truth of the matter, that Paul's ministry is different from Peter, James, and John, and the remnant believers of Israel. Because the unbelieving Jews don't have any problem with them. And that's amazing, because what I said, that the first point was something that people ignore. It's amazing that that's a major part of the book of Acts, is that Paul has a separate, distinct, different ministry. Everybody dealing with Paul knows it, but Bible students ignore it. But that's the most obvious thing here, is that Paul's ministry is different. And some are still figuring it out. We have the fortunate opportunity who have lived 2,000 years later. This is all hindsight for us. Plus, we have all of Paul's epistles to read to realize what his ministry to the Gentiles is, and how it was a mystery kept secret, not revealed. And that's why they're so confused about his ministry. They had no idea. They couldn't. There's nothing in the prophets that talked about Paul going out to the Gentiles before Israel comes into her blessings and offering them salvation through Israel's Messiah of all people. So anyhow, that just makes that stand out even before we get to chapter 22 here now. Now in chapter 22, Paul's defense is to the unbelieving Jews. And what he's going to do in this, when I broke down his defense is actually going to be verses 1 to 16. And in that those section of verses, he's going to take them through five stages of his life. And then in those five stages, I'll make sure I stop and point out each one, there is seven irrefutable evidences that the Apostle Paul is going to give them, that if anyone there cared to know the truth, that whether this ministry that Paul is carrying out among the Gentiles is legitimately of God, he's going to lay out enough evidence, 7 points, to prove it. And so he's going to take them through five stages of his life, bringing out these 7 points. And like I say, if anyone cared to know the truth, they would have he's calling it his defense. And they would have the means, they would know the truth about the legitimacy of his ministry. But the angry mob really isn't looking for the truth of it, but Paul's going to try to reason with them. So the first part of the first stage of his life is verses 1 through 3, where he's going to bring them, after he gets their attention, he's going to talk about his heritage. Verse 1, it says, Men, brethren, and fathers, hear ye my defense, which I make unto you. And when they heard that he spake in the Hebrew tongue to them, they kept the more silent. And he said, I am verily a man which am a Jew, born in Tarsus, a city in Cilicia, yet brought up in this city at the feet of Gamaliel, and taught according to the perfect manner of the law of the fathers, and was zealous toward God as ye all are this day. Actually, verse 3 does the whole heritage right there. The first of that is, that first verse 1, Paul, men and brethren, fathers, hear my defense. So it's really, almost like a court case here, even though he's not on trial, but he's going to defend himself and give them the proofs that he needs to defend himself with. And then he just kind of lays out his heritage there in verse 1. And while he talks about himself being a Jew, and then he talks about himself born in Tarsus. Do you remember when we looked in chapter 21, verse 39? It was kind of the end. We were rushing through the verses, but it said, chapter 21, verse 9, it's 21, verse 39, it says, Paul said, I am a man. Now, he's actually talking to the Roman captain here. I am a man which am a Jew of Tarsus, a city in Cilicia, a citizen of no mean city. And that is no base city. Tarsus wasn't just some little city in Cilicia. It was a major city in Cilicia. And to my surprise, I told you that in reading, I found out that it was a city of a university city, and that it rivaled, actually, the encyclopedia I read said it excelled in Greek philosophy above Athens and Alexandria. So that that Paul was in a very cultured city. But when he says it to, he doesn't say that part about no mean city in verse 3 of chapter 22. He just simply says, a Jew born in Tarsus, a city in Cilicia, yet brought up in the city, in this city, at the feet of Gamaliel. So he doesn't brag about Tarsus. In fact, if Tarsus was a center of education of Greek philosophy, Paul makes it real clear that even though I was in that city, I grew up here in Jerusalem, sitting under the feet of Gamaliel, being instructed in the perfect manner of the law. And so he wasn't, influenced by Greek or by Gentile. His heritage is rooted deep in Israel. In other places, he brags about being of the tribe of Benjamin, a Hebrew of the Hebrew, being a Pharisee. And so he brags about all these connections with Jews that when he says at the end of that verse 3, as ye all are this day, he's identifying with them. And so he brings their attention that, yeah, I'm born in Tarsus, but I was brought up in this city, Jerusalem, at the feet of Gamaliel. And so to impress them, to make them stop and think. When he says he taught by Gamaliel, now Gamaliel was a famous rabbi in Israel. Actually, he's called a Pharisee. Look back in chapter 5. You'll probably remember him from this chapter. And just like I looked up Tarsus in the encyclopedia, tried to get a little bit about that, I also looked up Gamaliel. One of the things about Gamaliel to keep in mind is there's a lot written about him. He's one who you can trace his heritage, where he taught and what he taught and how he was looked up to, and all that in an encyclopedia. I say that to you because when we come to the Bible and we start talking about people, places, events, the Bible is always 100% historically accurate. Now, that's not true of other people when they write their little, whether it be the Quran or whether it be the Book of Mormons. They can't verify any people, places, events historically in those books because they're just made up stories. In fact, the Quran is just a guy twisting all the Bible to try and make it sound like the Bible. But anyhow, but the Bible is historically accurate. And just like I say that to you because sometimes maybe you don't really think about the fact that Jesus Christ, if there was no Bible, is still a historical figure that you could read about, and his claims about being Israel's Messiah and the claims of his miracles are all recorded outside the Bible by historians. And so these things are factual. There is this Gamaliel, but also everything I read in the encyclopedia, nothing explains Gamaliel better than the Bible does. In chapter 5 of Acts, in verse 34, when they had arrested, now this is before Paul was saved, they arrested Peter and John after they healed the lame man in the temple, and the crowds all gathered, and they're trying to figure out what to do with them. And so they got them under arrest, and verse 34 says, then stood up one in the council, a Pharisee named Gamaliel, a doctor of the law, had in reputation among all people, and commanded to put the apostles forth a little space. But see all that detail about Gamaliel in that verse? You can read an encyclopedia and learn all about that too, but it said it so quick and right to the point. But you realize, like when it says, had in reputation among all the people, Now think about Paul in chapter 22. He's got the people's attention. He's speaking Hebrew. He said he was born in Tarsus, but brought up in that city. So now he's more dedicated to the Jews at the feet of Gamaliel. Well, I don't think anybody could actually be a tutored by a pupil of Gamaliel, but Paul was. And if Gamaliel had a reputation, you know, you better think about this pupil of Gamaliel, Saul of Tarsus, the Apostle Paul, and better hear what he has to say. But anyhow, you see the credentials of Gamaliel in verse 34, and in just case you forgot what he's going to do here, he exercises a lot of wisdom. I wonder if Paul ever had a chance to witness to him the gospel. There's no record. But verse 34 says, and said unto them, so they take the apostles and put them away. Now he's going to speak to the council. And he said unto them, ye men of Israel, take heed to yourselves what ye intend to do as touching these men. For before these days rose up Thaddeus, boasting himself to be somebody, to whom a number of men, about 400, joined themselves. There was 4,000 on that other group on there. It rung a bell there. Who was slain, and all as many as obeyed him were scattered and brought to naught. After this, this man rose up Judas of Galilee in the days of taxing and drew away much people after him. He also perished, and even as many as obeyed him were dispersed. And now I say unto you, refrain from these men and let them alone. For if this counsel or work be of men, it will come to naught. But if it be of God, ye cannot overthrow it, lest happily ye be found even to fight against God. And that's exactly what they were doing. That's, in fact, they quote the verse where the kings are come together against the Lord and his Christ. So anyhow, real great wisdom, as you see there, and a wise man that can think things through. But the point is he's a Pharisee, he's had a reputation, he's a doctor of the law, and he's Paul's teacher. So go back to chapter 22 then. That's Paul's tutoring in his heritage there. Now that actually brings me to what I would say the first proof, if Paul is giving a defense. This would be a legal proof by just mentioning Gamaliel's name and this association with Gamaliel. His heritage is documented in that anybody who's listening, if they're there in Jerusalem, they could actually go to Gamaliel. Like when you apply for a job, and sometimes in a job application, they ask about your education. A lot of people through the years have learned to lie and say they got this degree, that degree, went to that school. Even politicians, and then they find out they never went to that school, they don't have that degree. So now people, rather than just because you wrote it down, taking your word for it, they actually go to the school and check out to see if that's true. Well, that's what Paul's doing here. I sat at the feet of Gamaliel, was instructed in the perfect manner of the law, and any person who cared to know the truth could go to the school that Gamaliel taught at and look up the records to see if Paul was a pupil there, or go ask Gamaliel for a credit reference concerning the Apostle Paul. Because I bet you the Apostle Paul, when you know the things that are going to follow here, how he advanced in the Jewish religion, Gamaliel, he wasn't just some student that sat in the back that Gamaliel didn't recognize. He was one of my star prize, the Apostle Paul, or Saul of Tarsus at that time. So they could actually check. And so there's, if they're going to check out Paul's credentials, his character references, his heritage, it can be proven. And so he throws out a name so that they could actually go and prove it. And so he was, verse 3 again of chapter 22, I am verily a man, which am a Jew, born in Tarsus, a city in Cilicia, yet brought up in this city at the feet of Gamaliel, and taught according to the perfect manner of the law of the fathers, and was zealous toward God as ye all are this day. Paul says, what he's doing, and it's probably a good strategy, identify with your crowd. Hey, you and I were alike. You ever see that dumb commercial on TV where the guy has an accident, and he said, hey, we got something in common. Yeah. Oh, man, no, we don't. Yeah, we do. But here, Paul said, hey, I'm just like you. But really what he's saying, he says, I know exactly how you think. I know exactly how you feel. I've been there. I've done that. Now, they don't know what he's learned beyond that. But he certainly can identify with them, and he does so, talking about zealous as ye all are this day. And boy, they're zealous. They were going to kill him because they don't understand his ministry. So they were certainly zealous, and zealous to the point of killing someone who believed in this way. Well, that's the next verse. So verse 4 and 5, Paul's now going to take him to another section of his life, and this is his achievements in the Jewish religion. So that's how he was brought up. We got his heritage. Verse 4 and 5, he's going to talk about his achievements. Verse 4 says, and I persecuted this way unto the death, binding and delivering into prison both men and women, and also the high priest doth bear me witness, and all the estate of the elders, from whom I also received letters unto the brethren, and went to Damascus to bring them which were there bound unto Jerusalem for to be punished. So, you know, these guys are all mad. Here's Paul just around the temple in Jerusalem. Paul said, hey, I went all over Israel arresting men and women. And I went beyond that. I went all the way to Damascus to find anybody up there so I could drag them back to Jerusalem, put them on trial, and ultimately they would be put to death. So he was zealous like them, but actually he was more zealous than them. When he talks about his zeal, his achievements here in those verses, he's describing, and turn here because there's another, and hold your place even when we leave Galatians. Galatians chapter 1. Hold your place there because I'm going to say some things and come back here again. But Paul, when he described in Galatians, and it's you realize how he's writing to Gentiles when you're in Galatians, in chapter 2, he's identifying with the Jews as a Jew. But here he wants the Gentiles at Galatia to remember the same thing that he hasn't even expressed to the Jews yet, but the Gentile part of his ministry and the unique calling that he has and the gospel that's been given him to preach, he goes back to his heritage and he says in verse 13 of Galatians 1, for ye have heard of my conversation in time past. Now, the conversation is how he lived, his manner of life. Ye have heard of my conversation in time past in the Jews' religion, how that beyond measure I persecuted the church of God and wasted it, and profited in the Jews' religion above many mine equals in my own nation, being more exceedingly zealous of the traditions of my fathers. So, you know, you see there, he's talking about my father. He's talking to Gentiles, so he relates his past and his association with Israel. But when you're reading it in Acts, he's talking about, you know, there presently, not, you know, back when he was in the Jews' religion, how he excelled. But the point is that in chapter 22, verses 4 and 5, when he talks about that he did, he's actually teaching, showing how he actually, if they think they're zealous, he excelled. He's more exceedingly zealous than they were in the Jews' religion, in the tradition of the fathers. And so, you know, he's expressing that, and those are part of his achievements. Now, hold your place in Galatians, but back in chapter 22, he says in that verse 4, I persecuted this way unto the death. Now, this way, that's an interesting thing, because exactly what he's on trial for, he's not actually talking about his Gentile ministry. When he says this way, that's a reference to the way of Jesus Christ. John chapter 6 and verse 14, Jesus said, I am the way, the truth, and the life. No man cometh to the Father but by me. Now, like I told you, the believing Jews are Jews who believe that Jesus is the way. In fact, look at chapter 9. This is where what the incident Paul is describing in chapter 22. Remember, chapter 22 of Acts is Paul's words. Chapter 9 of Acts is Luke's word. Luke telling us historically about this conversion of the Apostle Paul. And when he does that, there'll be other things that we look back here for. But for right now, I just want you to see when Paul was planning to go, that what his thinking was. He says in verse 2, and desired of them, letters to Damascus to the synagogue that if he found any of this way, whether they were men or women, he might bring them bound unto Jerusalem. Well, see again, this way. And we're not talking about the way of grace to the Gentiles. We're just talking about the way of Jesus Christ, through Jesus Christ, to the Father. No man cometh to the Father but by me. The Apostle Paul preached Jesus Christ, and then he added the information of him crucified, but he did preach Jesus Christ and the resurrection, as well as additional information about the cross work of the Lord Jesus Christ. So at this point, when it says this way, he's referring to the way of Jesus Christ. And interesting, we're looking at that. Look at chapter 18 of Acts. In verse 25. Oh. Stop short. Now this is where Paul's disciples, Aquila and Priscilla, are taking Apollos. And anyhow, it says In verse 24, it says, "And a certain Jew named Apollos, born in Alexandria, an eloquent man, mighty in the scriptures, came to Ephesus. This man was instructed in the way of the Lord, and being more fervent in the spirit, he spake and taught diligently the things of the Lord, knowing only the baptism of John." And it says, and he began to speak boldly in the synagogue, whom when Aquila and Priscilla had heard, took him unto them and expounded unto him the way of God more perfectly. So he knows the way of the Lord, verse 25, instructed in the way of the Lord, and then they're going to add to that his knowledge later on. But there's that way. In fact, more precisely, the way that we're talking about, if you go back to chapter 15, it's chapter 16, verse 19. Oh, and this is where the demon-possessed girl was following him. 16 verse 17, it says, And the same followed Paul and cried, saying, "These men are the servants of the Most High God, which show unto us the way of salvation." So anyhow, the way that he's talking about is the way of salvation that's through Jesus Christ. Neither is there salvation in any other, for there's none other name under heaven given among men whereby we must be saved. So anyhow, he's preaching Christ. The reason I said all that, look at Galatians now in chapter 1 and verse, after Paul gives his heritage and the Damascus account in the book of Galatians, he then goes through Syria and Cilicia, and it says in verse 22, this is when he's on his way to Tarsus, he says, Galatians 1:22, "And was unknown by face unto the churches of Judea, which were in Christ. But they had heard only that he which persecuted us in times past now preaches the faith which he once destroyed." And I don't know if you've ever been stumped where someone, you're trying to explain and you're using the book of Galatians to explain to someone that Paul has a unique calling to the Gentiles, and back up in chapter 1 verse 11 Paul says that his revelation he didn't get from men, he got it from Jesus Christ. Then someone grabs verse 23 and says, no, he just preached the same thing that he once destroyed. And you know, it seems it's contrary to the context, especially if you go into chapter 2, he's now going to go to Jerusalem and explain that gospel that he preaches to the Gentiles, to the 12 apostles, because they don't know what he's preaching. He's preaching something different. But they grab verse 23 and say, no, he's preaching the same thing. Well, there's only one part of the same thing that he's preaching. He's preaching the same Christ, and he's preaching the resurrected Jesus Christ, and that's part of the faith that he wants destroyed. That way, the way of Christ, the way of salvation through Jesus Christ. But he there was more added to that than just the preaching of Jesus Christ and the resurrection. It was the preaching of Jesus Christ who rose from the dead according to Paul's gospel. And then there's additional information. But some people grab verse 23 and try to ignore the context of the two chapters with one verse.
And it says they heard, so it's secondhand information anyway.
Yeah, I never thought of that. But the faith he once destroyed, he's preaching Christ. You know, he used to hate that way, the way of Christ. So anyhow, that's what's being said back there in chapter 22. So go of Acts back to 22. Another just a when Paul talks about that zeal that he had, more exceedingly zealous than they all, in describing that, you know, it's one thing to beat on Paul, but that verse 4 of verse 20 of chapter 22, and I persecuted this way unto the death. So Paul did persecute people and have them either, you know, like Stephen was one, that when he was put to death, Saul was consenting unto his death. And hopefully you know when I say Saul, Paul, before Acts 13, he was always called Saul, but his name was Paul, and as he goes to the Gentiles, the Gentile name, we know him as Paul the Apostle, but to the Jews, they refer to him as Saul, and we're back here in the time that he was unsaved, and so he's known as Saul. But when he persecuted, and what I was going to say at Stephen, he was consenting unto Stephen's death, as if he's the ringleader, the leader of the rebellion, trying to stamp out the name of Jesus Christ. But when he put people to death, he said, binding and delivering into prison both men and women. No mercy. You know, if you're binding men and women, don't some of these women have kids? You think Paul cared? Now, he might care for the kid, but what he thought was blasphemy, believing that Jesus is the Christ, he was so zealous that it didn't matter if it was a man or if it was a woman, he bound them both and was consenting unto their death until they were put to death. And so he's almost merciless in his attempt, but it's in his zeal. He said before, as we read the verse, he thought he was doing God's will. So anyhow, that's Paul's achievement in the Jews' religion. Now, even before I leave this section, here's proof number two. In verse 5, it says, as also the high priest doth bear me witness. Go ask Gamaliel about me, what I've learned, what kind of student I was. And then concerning my zeal and my achievement in the Jews' religion, go ask the high priest. He'll bear witness of me. That high priest knows who he is and what Saul used to do. And not just the high priest, proof number 3, and all the estate of the elders. Now, it doesn't just say, and all the elders. When he says all the estate of the elders, we're not just talking about the estate like what they own as far as their house is concerned. Estate meaning stately elders, statesmen of Israel, people that are high social ranking leaders in Israel. That's why they're called elders. That whole phrase, all the state of the elders. Not only the high priest, but even the high leadership of the people of Israel, the governing part of Israel, not the religious part, but the governing part. Them, and then it says, not just them, here's proof number 4. It says, from whom also I received letters unto the brethren and went to Damascus to bring them that were there bound unto Jerusalem for to be punished. Well, if the high priest and the elders wrote a letter to give to Paul to go to Damascus so that when he got there, he could present it to the Jewish leadership that's at Damascus, saying, I have this right to arrest any who's believing in Jesus as the Christ, to bring them bound to Jerusalem for trial, back to Jerusalem for trial. He actually had letters, and those letters had signatures of the high priest and all those stately elders. So that proof, you can check out Gamaliel, go ask the high priest, ask those leaders in Israel, and if they deny it, go look for the document. Because there's got to be a copy on record of when I went there, what right I had to arrest Jews and bring them back to Jerusalem. He didn't do that on his own orders. So there's proof again concerning his zeal and his achievements for as representative of the Jews' religion. Now all this, remember, is going to point to the fact that there's something changed. And they can't just overlook this because look at who he is and what he's been through. So that brings us to the next point of his life. And that is the experience that changed his life. And it begins in verse 6 and runs through verse 10. So let me read those verses. It says, "And it came to pass that as I made my journey and was come nigh unto Damascus, about noon, suddenly there shone from heaven a great light around me. And I fell unto the ground, and I heard a voice saying unto me, Saul, Saul, why persecutest thou me? And I answered, Who art thou, Lord? And he said unto me, I am Jesus of Nazareth, whom thou persecutest. And they that were with me saw indeed the light and were afraid, but they heard not the voice of him that spake unto me. And I said, What shall I do, Lord? And the Lord said unto me, Arise and go to Damascus, and there it shall be told thee of all things which are appointed for thee to do." So this is the experience now that's going to change his life. I mean, he's top leader, identifying, just like you guys are, I'm even more exceedingly zealous than you were. I've achieved, go check my credentials. But this event took place. And the event that took place, it starts out, at verse 6 again, "And it came to pass, as I made my journey and was come nigh unto Damascus." I probably said it back in chapter 9, but that's an important point that Paul always makes. Because if you stop and think about it, and I said, remember coming out of chapter 21, they're getting along with other Jews that believe, but Paul's association with Gentiles, they just can't handle that. Well, when Paul had this experience that changed his life, it was outside the borders of Israel. He's going to Damascus. Damascus is in Syria. And apparently he had whoever ruled that territory allowed the Jews to have that much law and control of their own nation that Paul could even go to Damascus and arrest people and bring them back to Jerusalem bound. But when it says he came nigh unto Damascus, he's now outside of the land of Israel. And something spiritual, divine took place in his life. Outside the land of Israel. That's the first clue that would substantiate his Gentile ministry. It's kind of slight there, but it's one that should be noticed. And so he's nigh unto the road to Damascus, and it's like the Lord waited for him to cross the border and then speak to the Apostle Paul, or Saul of Tarsus, and call him for his purpose. When he was there nigh unto Damascus, he said, it says, about noon. Why the time? Well, high noon. If it was a clear day and that sun is shining bright on his head at high noon, there is a light that's brighter than the sun that's going to put that sun to shame, that's going to shine on him. So the point is that he waits till noon, and suddenly, they're shown from heaven a great light round about me. Well, the sunlight is pretty bright, isn't it? But here's a light that's brighter than the sun. And notice the reference there, shined around me. Not just shined from heaven and covered the whole territory, but that light shined from heaven, so that's God doing it, shining a light right on Paul. And it's high noon, but this is not sunlight. This is a brighter than the sunlight. It's God's light. Which takes you back, you know, the Jews, when it talks about light and God, there is some things they know about that. I'm always interested in God. In Genesis 1, he creates heaven and earth. Chapter 2, it's covered with darkness and water, and it's void. And then in verse 3 of Genesis 1, God said, "Let there be light." It's not until verse 14 that God creates a greater light to serve the day and a lesser light to serve the night. And he put the stars in the firmament of heaven and lined them up to shine and be for signs and seasons, days and years. So verse 14, he creates the sunlight to shine on the earth and the moon to bring light on the earth at night and set those stars out there for a proper order and for signs that later show up in the Bible. But what's that light back in verse 3? Verse 3 when he said, "Let there be light." And what it is verse 2, when the world was dark and covered with water, without form and void, God had withdrawn his presence from the earth. It's the very presence of God coming back to the earth and now making the earth in those 7 days, which we call 7 days of creation, but he made the earth in 7 days, a little different than creating, making. He took what's there and then fashioned it, and among that is the sunlight. So that when we start talking about this light brighter than the sun, there's an identification there that this is God. In fact, go to Isaiah chapter 9. We read this in Sunday school not long ago, and it depends how familiar you are with like the book of Matthew and the early ministry of Jesus Christ, if you can identify this verse. It says, Isaiah chapter 9, and let's see, verse 1. Woe unto them that decree unrighteous decrees, and that right, that's verse 10, chapter 10, verse 9, chapter 9, verse 1. Nevertheless, the dimness shall not be such as was in her vexation, talking about Israel, when at first he lightly afflicted the land of Zebulun and the land of Naphtali, and afterwards did more grievously afflict her by the way of the sea beyond Jordan in Galilee of the nations. The people that walked in darkness have seen a great light, and they that dwell in the land of the shadow of death, upon them hath light shined. So God chastened Israel in the past, first by Assyria coming down, and then he's going to afflict them again at another time, but then they're going to have this great light. That verse 2 is fulfilled in the very first coming of Jesus Christ, because when he began his ministry, he began it in the north, in Nazareth. Remember, that's who Paul's going to ask, who are you, Lord? He's going to say, Jesus of Nazareth. That's up there in the north. And when you read Matthew chapter 4, it says that this verse was fulfilled when Jesus Christ began his public ministry up in Nazareth. The people that walked in darkness, it says, have seen a great light, and they that dwell in the land of the shadows of death, unto them a light shined. So that Jesus Christ is that light that came to them. And that's who's appearing to the Apostle Paul, that light. Before I leave Isaiah, come over to chapter 60. Isaiah 60. When it talks about the Lord, chapter 59, verses 20 and 21 is about the second coming of Jesus Christ, of Isaiah 59. And then as he comes, it says in chapter 60, verse 1, arise, shine, for thy light is come, and the glory of the Lord is risen upon thee. And behold, the darkness shall cover the earth, gross darkness the people, but the Lord shall arise upon thee, and his glory shall be seen upon thee. God's going to come, Jesus Christ is going to return in glory. And it's going to be the glory of the Lord in the second coming of Jesus Christ. Well, when Paul says a great light shined from heaven around about me, that's the glory of Jesus Christ shining on Paul. In verse 19 of Isaiah 60, it says, the sun shall be no more thy light by day, neither for brightness, neither shall the moon give light unto thee, but the Lord shall be unto thee an everlasting light, and thy God thy glory. Well, they don't. If the glory of Jesus Christ is going to be in their presence, you won't be able to see the sunlight, because his glory is brighter than the sun. Well, this is the light that Paul said, a great light. It was at noon, but a greater light shined on me from heaven. So the Jews know these verses. They know what Paul's talking about, that there's been a revelation given to him or a vision given to him of God. Now, he's going to identify who God is in a moment, but those are the verses. It also, when you connect all those, just go to John chapter 1 because of the beauty of how the book of John begins. Sometimes, because I'm not artistic and poetry doesn't flow out of me too well, that I read this and understand it, but Even just after what we just saw, you certainly can appreciate how John opens up the book of John, declaring who Jesus Christ is. Watch these verses. Verse 1 of the book of John. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. Now that verse 14, the Word was made flesh and dwelt amongst us. That's the Lord Jesus Christ. That's why it's capital W. The Word was God. All things were made by Him, and without Him was not anything made that was made. In Him was life, and the life was the light of men. Life and light are mixed there. The light shineth in darkness, and the darkness comprehended it not. Jesus Christ shines in the nation of Israel, and they can't do anything. They can't put out that light. There was a man sent from God whose name was John. The same came for a witness to bear witness of the light, that all men through him might believe. He was not the light, but was sent to bear witness of that light. That was the true light, which lighteth every man that cometh into the world. So Jesus Christ is the light that gives life, and we're talking about everlasting life. And Jesus Christ was that light that came into the world, and the world can't comprehend it, light, whatever light is, the darkness just flees. And that's what they had to do from the presence of the Lord. So here's Saul of Tarsus, and a light shines down from heaven upon him. And certainly that's the Lord revealing himself to him. Go back to chapter 22. I'll get to a closing point here. So the light shines on him, there's this voice. It's first a voice, later on it's called the voice. But in verse 7 says, and I fell to the ground and heard a voice saying unto me, Saul, Saul, why persecutest thou me? So he falls, there's this great light, he falls, does it say he falls to the ground? I keep saying that. I fell to the ground, okay. The reason I say that is, never mind. I think he's got like his head down, but he don't. He's looking up because he's going to go blind from the light. That's what I'm getting wrong in my own thinking. But he falls to the ground, and when he's on that ground, he hears a voice saying unto him, he identifies, Saul, Saul, why persecutest thou me? Now remember, he's stamping out any who believes in this way, the way of Christ. He answers with a question. That's what every guilty person does. Who art thou, Lord? See, he knows, just like I said, the Jews know this light is God. Saul knew this light was God. And that I'm persecuting you, who are you? So there's a conversation, and the answer comes back. And he said unto me, I am Jesus of Nazareth, whom thou persecutest. And verse 9 I'll read and close. It says, and when they that were with me saw indeed the light and were afraid, but they heard not the voice of him that spake unto me. Now, there's a couple things we're going to say about the voice and the conversation that Paul is having there, but I want to end with proof number 5. There's a group of men. There must be a lot of men with Paul. If he's going to arrest a whole bunch of people and bring them back to be tried, he's got some kind of an army of Jews with him, not a Roman army, but an army of Jews. And whatever number of people those are, Paul is saying those that were with him saw indeed the light. So if you don't think that God appeared, a light shined around me, a light greater than the sun, God shone his glorious Shekinah glory on me, go ask all those men who were with me. They saw indeed the light. Now your homework assignment. It says they didn't hear the voice. Read chapter 9, what Luke says. It says they heard the voice. And explain to me next week that there's no contradictions in the Bible. Let's pray. Oh, you're not going to answer your question, right?
I just wanted to point out.
Good.